Our next case, 11-1201, 11-1362, Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation versus Dwayne Schwartzwald et al. For the appellant, Mr. Engel.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Andrew Engel, and I'm here today representing the appellants, Dwayne and Julie Schwartzwald. Your Honor, I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The Schwartzwalds are here today advancing the unremarkable proposition that in order for a plaintiff to invoke the power of a common pleas court in Ohio, the plaintiff has to have standing to file the suit in the first place. Now, I say that's unremarkable because I'm sure I recall my first year of law school sitting through several very dull lectures about the requirement of standing, and I'm just sure that Professor Vaughn said that you had to have standing before you could open the courthouse door and ask for relief. Now, I could well understand where someone who read the Court of Appeals decision or some of the other cases that Freddie Mac relies on might conclude that Ohio no longer has a standing requirement. However, I believe that the long series of cases that this court has issued clearly indicates that standing doctrine is alive and well in Ohio. Now,
it's your position. I mean, your clients were clearly in default, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And they were working on a short sale, and they feel like they got hoodwinked by this foreclosure being filed, which is a story that's happened over and over, right?
That's correct.
And eventually, if they didn't do the short sale, somebody would have foreclosed on them. So it's an issue of who had the right. And it's basically your position, if I understand from the briefs, that standing cannot be cured. You have to have it when you first file the suit, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the only thing you gain here is this action being dismissed and somebody who's now cured all the paperwork refiling it.
That's in part true, Your Honor.
And what has your client gained except time to live in the house still?
What does my client gain? The client gains a real judgment.
Okay.
Here's the problem. This court has repeatedly held that standing is an initial inquiry that must be established before a court addresses the merits.
What is the purpose of all of our case law and rules that say that you can substitute the real party in interest if it's not in the original suit?
Well, I believe that question assumes that real party in interest and standing are the same, and I don't believe that's the case.
Well, wouldn't somebody who wasn't the real party in interest, how would they have standing? That's where you lose me in your argument.
Now, someone who is not a real party in interest cannot have standing.
Okay, so somebody who's not a real party in interest does not have standing, then why do we have rules that say you can be substituted? Because if they didn't have standing because they weren't the real party in interest, substitution wouldn't work. You'd have to dismiss and refile all over again.
Your Honor, with all due respect, you're saying that real party in interest and standing are the same thing.
No, I'm just saying if you accept your argument that if the person who filed was not the real party in interest, they didn't have standing. Let's accept that as the proposition.
Okay.
Then what are the rules we have on substitution totally worthless? Because you can't substitute a real party in interest because the suit was not valid in the first place.
There are certain people who have standing who are not the real party in interest. And standing goes to the constitutional grant of jurisdiction of Ohio Common Pleas Courts. Standing requires injury to a legally protected right. Now, you can have several people who can claim an injury as a result of some wrongful conduct. The question then becomes whether those people are the real party in interest, whether those people own and possess the right being vindicated.
So if the original people in the chain had a mortgage that was defaulted on, and then they subsequently sold it down the chain, they were damaged, but they're no longer the real party in interest. That's where I lose your argument, too.
Okay. Your Honor, in the state of Ohio, this court said in Grant Thornton versus Windsor House, we're dealing with contracts here. We have two contracts. We have a promissory note, and we also have a mortgage. In Grant Thornton, the court held that in Ohio, only a party to a contract or a third-party beneficiary may bring an action on the contract. And my view is that's a statement of standing. Now, I don't necessarily, to me, it doesn't follow that both of those people are real party in interest. Assume you and I have a contract. And one of the terms of the contract is that Justice Cupp is an intended third-party beneficiary. I breached the contract. As a result, both Justice Cupp and yourself have a claim against me. If Justice Cupp files the suit, he has standing because he, under the Grant Thornton rule, he has been injured, and he's got a legally protected right. Me as a defendant, I'm not just going to let him prosecute the claim. Your Honor, I'm going to want you in the case, too. Why? Because my duty, although he's the beneficiary, my duty is owed to you. And because it's owed to you, after I finish beating him in court, I don't want to have to face you with the same issue. You hold the right. You are the one who can completely discharge me of my obligation. Those are real parties in interest is a subset of those who have standing. Now, I've touched on the fact that standing is an absolute requirement. I've touched on the fact that this is because of Article 4, Section 4B of the Ohio Constitution. And that provision requires or provides that Ohio Common Pleas courts only have jurisdiction over justiciable matters and over those cases that the General Assembly grants them jurisdiction. Now, the Court of Appeals decision stated, well, you know, the General Assembly has given Common Pleas courts jurisdiction over foreclosure matters. That's the end of the story. But it's not. As this court stated in Progress Ohio versus Kasich, the beginning analysis starts with the constitutional grant of jurisdiction. That is the source of a Common Pleas court's jurisdiction. Therefore, the General Assembly cannot grant a Common Pleas court more broader jurisdiction than the Constitution grants. And that's the problem we have. The concept of justiciability requires adverse interests, present adverse interests, because this court doesn't, no court in Ohio wants to get into the business of issuing advisory opinions or opinions on prospective, potential disputes. We need adverse parties. Barclays Bank case is a good example of that, although it dealt with the other side
of
the...
Counsel, are you saying that during the pendency of the proceedings, if there is some question as to standing that cannot be cured during the pendency of the proceedings, that that issue has to be in place, ironclad, at the time of the filing of the foreclosure?
Yes, ma'am. Because that is necessary to invoke the jurisdiction of the court. That is necessary to commence the case. If it is not present when the case is filed, the case was not properly commenced.
So what happens in situations where the wrong defendant in a civil action is named and it has to be substituted for the right defendant?
You're talking about defendants? Well, that was the instance in the Barclays Bank case, Your Honor, where Barclays Bank sought a writ of prohibition from the court because it said, look, the plaintiff down in the Common Pleas court has a beef, but that beef isn't with us. That beef is really with the guy back here. And because we're just the correspondent bank honoring a standby letter of credit, we're not an adverse party. It's that you have to have those adverse legal interests for a case to be justiciable. And without those adverse legal interests, it's not justiciable. Common Pleas Court doesn't have jurisdiction.
But then they substitute the party, the correct party.
In that case, Your Honor, no. The court granted the writ of prohibition.
No, I'm not talking about that case. I'm talking about normally what happens is that if you've identified the incorrect defendant, you can serve the defendant.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Certainly. But that goes to whether or not you've got all the proper parties. Yes. Perhaps that does happen. Frankly, I'm not familiar with such cases. You may have someone else being joined later to a case, but I've not experienced
where the person that was originally named is dismissed as having been incorrectly named as a defendant.
I haven't.
Mr. Engel, can I bring you to this case? As I understand it, on April 15th, Freddie Mac filed this foreclosure action and alleged that it held the note in the mortgage.
Correct.
Is that right?
That's what they alleged.
And in the allegation, they didn't hold the note in the mortgage on that date.
They alleged they did, but the facts, the paperwork, did not support it.
When did they actually come into possession of either the note or the mortgage, to your knowledge?
Your Honor, the issue of when Freddie Mac came in possession of the note was never established at the trial court.
When did it file the assignment?
Okay. The assignment was executed, I believe, May 15th, a full month after the lawsuit was filed.
All right. And the assignment to them would have had standing at that point, in your view?
At that point, based on the Court of Appeals decision on that point, it was at that point, May 15, when the assignment was executed, that arguably Freddie Mac became a person entitled to enforce the note under the UCC.
Now, my question is, what would have been the reason that they would have filed a foreclosure action against your clients a month before they had the, in your view, the standing to file the case?
Pick up a newspaper. The volume of foreclosures has gone through the roof because the number of people.
Were they servicing the loan at that point?
No, I do not believe Freddie Mac was servicing. I don't believe they service any of their own loans, Your Honor.
It was part
but
of
what
the
I'm trying to figure out is we have a lawyer who files a lawsuit on behalf of an agency and names a defendant who is in default of a mortgage, but that lawyer doesn't actually have the note or the mortgage. I'm trying to figure out what the thinking process is that would enable them to do that, and I'm sure you must have looked at that.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I can speculate as to the reasons for that. And it's important to note that although Freddie Mac claimed to be the holder of the note, there was no note attached to the complaint. In fact, Freddie Mac stated a copy of the note is currently unavailable. Why would they do it? There was a lot of pressure across the board in the mortgage industry to liquidate bad loans. Just a tremendous amount of pressure. Why would an attorney do that? Because the law firms, too, were under pressure. Servicers were under pressure from the people ultimately holding.
Is it your view that if the action had been recommenced, as you indicated to earlier questioning, let's see, it was actually filed in April, and you said that the assignment was dated May 15th.
Yes, sir.
So it could have been recommenced 30 days later, and you would have had no issue.
Which the Court of Appeals found, assuming that, in fact, Freddie Mac had physical possession of the real note, assuming that, yes, they could have filed their case then on May 15th.
But that is the issue, and I just want to clarify the timeline because I have my notes. It's been some time since I read, so help me with this because this was all about the robo-signing, and there was an affidavit by somebody who said they had personally signed, but they had not. So what I wrote down, and I want to make sure I'm correct on this, is that there was a transfer on May 15th, 2009, from Wells Fargo to Freddie Mac, but that Freddie Mac didn't file the assignment of the mortgage until December 14th, 2009, with the court. Am I incorrect on those dates?
No, I believe you're correct.
But that's when they actually produced the assignment was some 6 months after the case had originally been filed.
I believe that's true, Your Honor, yes. Freddie Mac and its counsel filed various things with the court. At one point, they filed a copy of the note. At one point, they filed one mortgage assignment. At another point, they filed both mortgage assignments. But you're correct. It was not until May 15th that an assignment of the mortgage was executed. And that's important because the Court of Appeals determined that language included in the assignment of the mortgage purported to also transfer an interest in the promissory note. Now, although it's my position that that can't happen, that the mortgage assignment is not effective to transfer the note, what the mortgage assignment does do, and this is what the Court of Appeals relied on, was it indicated an intent by Wells Fargo to transfer the rights of a holder to Freddie Mac.
Well, counsel, what typically happens is Wells Fargo was the mortgage holder. They serviced it. They then gave it or sold it to Freddie Mac, transferred it. Freddie Mac didn't get their paperwork in place. Wells Fargo continued to be the servicer on the mortgage because Freddie Mac doesn't service its own paper. And the paperwork caught up to the what was the real situation with Freddie Mac being the owner and Wells Fargo continuing to be the servicing entity for this mortgage. And it was in default, and they were in negotiations with Wells Fargo, as you would be normally with your servicing, not with the mortgage holder, correct?
Normally correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so then it came time to, proceed against your clients based on the situation that they found themselves in with this piece of property, and they internally put the documents in order that reflected what was the real situation between Freddie Mac and Wells Fargo.
I don't know that, Your Honor, and the record does not reflect that, in fact, as of the date of filing in April, Freddie Mac had any interest in either the note or the mortgage. It certainly was, Freddie Mac was certainly not the holder of the note, as was alleged. Freddie Mac certainly had not been assigned the mortgage, which had been alleged. We don't know when any discussions between Wells Fargo and Freddie Mac occurred, whereby they discussed whether...
Freddie Mac, though, initiated the proceedings against your client, correct?
Correct.
So what are you saying, that they just decided to pull your client's name out of a hat and file a lawsuit against them?
No, we don't know. That. I don't know. I would love to have the answer to that, Your Honor, as to what really happened. But we have to go back to both the Grant Thornton case, which requires a party... in order to file a lawsuit, you have to be a part of the agreement. The other thing that we have to keep in mind is the UCC in this case, Revised Code 1303.31, which defines those people entitled to enforce a note. And my view of that provision is that it, in fact, defines who has standing to sue on a note.
Counsel, had there been a motion to dismiss when the paperwork was not available, there would be no question that the court would have to dismiss the action. Is that correct?
If I had initially, instead of answering, filed a motion to dismiss, I believe so, yes, because the paperwork attached to the complaint did not substantiate the allegations.
And then somewhere along in the proceeding, all of this materialized. Depending, I mean, the dates, it may have been, the transactions may have been formalized after the lawsuit was pending, but it eventually materialized before the judgment. But your argument is that even though nothing was done to bring the court's attention that there wasn't standing, it couldn't be cured in any event.
Well, I just want to clarify one point. In the answer that was filed, a lack of standing was raised, as well as, separately, the lack of real party and interest. But no, it was not raised in by way of a motion to dismiss.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Scott King. Seated with me today is Terry Posey. We represent Freddie Mac. The certified conflict case, Your Honors, presents the court with the opportunity to decide four important questions of Ohio law. Who's entitled to enforce the note? Who's entitled to foreclose on a mortgage securing payment of a promissory note? Is being the recorded mortgagee a requirement in order to commence a foreclosure action? And lastly, the question of timing. I will address the questions in that order.
Well, you got it sort of backwards, don't you? Isn't it important to know whether there's standing?
Your Honor, standing is something that is, of course, a requirement, but the
I don't think any of us doubt that the holder of the note is entitled to enforce it. The questions that you stated that you wanted to address first, those aren't questions that this case concerns. The case is about standing.
Your Honor, let me address both of your comments. There is an aspect to enforcement. It's 1303.31A2. This is a case where there was not evidence of a holder, but a person in possession with the rights of a holder, something the Second District's decision discusses. With respect to the issue of standing, yes, that is an issue in this case. And the answer to your question, does standing have to be shown? Of course. But what's done to show standing varies through the course of the proceeding. This Court's adopted just earlier this month a Lujan case from the U.S. Supreme Court on standing. In order to show standing at the pleading stage, all that's required is to allege facts upon which the law affords relief to the claimant. If those facts are alleged, that suffices to give the Court jurisdiction to proceed to adjudicate. As the case moves further,
say that again.
In order to invoke the court's jurisdiction, a plaintiff has to file a complaint that states a claim upon which the claimant is entitled to relief, the law affords the claimant relief. Those allegations in that complaint are all that's necessary to invoke jurisdiction. At that point, you have a justiciable matter, and the court can then proceed on with the case.
But the allegations must be actual fact, correct?
Your Honor, I disagree with that. If the allegations turn out to be false, then the court would get to the point, as in Lujan case, where the court could say, we no longer can proceed, this plaintiff doesn't have standing. And there might be Rule 11 consequences and consequences under 2323.51. But if the allegations turn out to be false, that would deprive the court of standing. And I can give
court
you a
court of standing? The court?
I'm sorry. I misspoke. It wouldn't deprive the plaintiff of standing. Thank you. I can give you another example. If I have an accident with Mr. Engel on the way here, and I allege that it was his fault and his negligence caused my accident and file a complaint to that effect, it turns out it wasn't true. It turns out he wasn't negligent. That would not mean that the court loses jurisdiction to decide the dispute.
But we're not talking about a legal issue. We're talking about the simple fact of we have a mortgage, we have a note on a specific date, we are coming to court. And you're saying that if that's false, the individual still can have standing?
Your Honor, the individual at that point would be alerted to the lack of standing, and Rule 17 would then come into play. And the action could not be dismissed unless the real party in interest or joined, substituted, or ratified the action. So even if, as of the date of the filing of the complaint, the individual did not have standing, if there's ratification, Rule 17 tells us that the action is to proceed. In fact, the rule is quite clear that the action is to proceed as if it was commenced in the name of the real party.
And you're saying real party in interest is equal to standing?
In this particular case, the courts always analyze the two side by side. The courts always analyze standing and real party interest as the same.
But are they the same in your view? They're not. It's not the real party in interest being a subset of standing?
I can give you examples where somebody would, let me back up. Standing is measured by having, among other things, a direct injury. There are those that could have a direct injury and not be the real party in interest. In this context, the owner of a note. 1303.31 makes clear the owner of the note is not the real party in interest to bring the action, but the owner of the note could have standing.
So you agree with counsel in his definition of the two to us earlier?
At least analytically, I can see the distinction. This court's never adopted that distinction in its decisions, but analytically, I can see a situation where that would be the case.
So you're, if I understand your argument is that when you file, hopefully you're filing with a good faith basis, believing that you have the right to do so, and as the case proceeds forward and you discover things happen like the note got sold, your argument is that you are, the court has now assumed jurisdiction and those matters can be cured as the case proceeds rather than those have to be dismissed and refiled. Is that your argument?
Your Honor, that is exactly my argument. That is consistent throughout the civil rules. Chief Justice gave the example of the wrong defendant being sued. The court doesn't lose jurisdiction and the whole proceeding become void. Rather, the civil rules permit the substitution of the defendant in the Chief Justice's example, or in this example, ratification, or, and you just asked me, if the note had been sold, the substitution of the new party.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you a question about whether or not there had been a motion to dismiss or something earlier in the case before all the paperwork caught up. So if there had been a motion to dismiss or a motion for judgment on the pleadings or something of that nature, what would have been the defendant's response in order to keep the suit alive in the court?
Rule 17 counsels that the plaintiff in that case would have to be given the opportunity to either demonstrate that it was the real party in interest or authorization, substitution, ratification by the real party in interest. If after affording the plaintiff the opportunity for substitution, joinder, or ratification, plaintiff doesn't do it, then the case has to be dismissed because at that point there would be no jurisdiction. But Rule 17 is quite clear that if in fact that occurs, it is to be treated as if the action had been commenced appropriately.
Can I ask you a question that caught my eye in reading through the briefs, and it's from the Federal Third Circuit Court of Appeals, because it's interesting to me, and the Third Circuit basically quotes that financial institutions are so insistent on holding their customers to compliance with very ritualistic standards and criteria of contracts. And yet, when we come to cases like this, you want the court to relax the standards and say, well, no, it doesn't apply. Why should this court find a more relaxed rule for Freddie Mac than Freddie Mac would otherwise give to its customers?
With respect, Your Honor, Freddie Mac is only asking to be treated as the civil rules require every litigant to be treated. The rules permit real party and interests to be substituted. They permit ratification. Freddie Mac is asking for to be treated no differently
than any
other litigant.
But what would have been the problem with Freddie Mac waiting until they actually had the note and mortgage to bring the lawsuit?
Your Honor, the allegations – actually, I'll do it this way. The allegations of the complaint were sufficient to bring the lawsuit. Your question would nullify Rule 17. Rule 17 permits the post-filing curing, either by authorization, ratification, joinder, substitution. So your question would make Rule 17 unnecessary.
We're not even getting to Rule 17. My question is, before you file the lawsuit, there was no urgency. The house wasn't going to get up and leave. It's simply, why couldn't Freddie Mac wait until, because according to this, the transfer didn't even happen until 30 days after the foreclosure was filed. Why not simply wait until you had the note and mortgage in hand before filing the complaint?
Your Honor, and this record doesn't reflect the fact that Freddie Mac had the note in hand. I believe that in fact was the case. 7 days after this action was commenced, a copy, unauthenticated, a copy of the note was filed showing that it was bearer paper, enforceable by anyone in its possession. However, the record, as you've correctly pointed out, doesn't show that there was a transfer of the mortgage until 30 days after the filing of the action.
Where in the record is the bearer paper?
There is a notice of filing of the note. It is dated April 24, 2009. It was served April 22, 2009. And it's unauthenticated. It's not sufficient Rule 56 evidence, but a copy of the note endorsed by Legacy and then endorsed in blank by Wells Fargo is in fact in the record. But that wasn't the summary judgment record that we ended up with in the second.
But that gets it to Wells Fargo.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Said that transfer from Legacy to Wells Fargo is what that...
There were two endorsements on the note. The first endorsement was a specific endorsement from Legacy to Wells Fargo, and then there was another endorsement of the note by Wells Fargo in
the
blank.
The bearer.
In blank, so it became bearer paper.
Okay.
And those issues were not challenged by the Schwarzwalders. They didn't have any opposing documentation to say that was wrong or different.
There is no evidence in the record that anybody besides Freddie Mac was, in fact, supposed to be the correct holder. We now get into an argument as to whether the evidence was sufficient to show that Freddie Mac was a person entitled to enforce.
So Freddie Mac then allegedly has this bearer paper, and that was what authorized Freddie Mac to authorize their counsel to go forward with foreclosure. I'm presuming this was not the only foreclosure that they were authorizing. It was a bulk group of foreclosures. These happened to be one of them?
Your Honor, I don't know that there was a bulk group of foreclosures, but Freddie Mac did authorize the filing of this foreclosure action.
And then they cured the, I don't know whether you, the I guess the mortgage, filing of the mortgage lien, subsequent to the filing of the complaint?
If the answer is yes, Your Honor, that's the evidence that the record reflects, because the copy of the bearer paper was not authenticated. And so,
but they didn't authenticate the bearer paper. They put a filing of the assignment on subsequent, correct?
Correct.
When did that filing of the assignment take place?
The assignment was executed on May 15, 2009. It was filed in the recorder's office on May 27th. It was filed, as Justice noted, in the court on December 14th, 2009.
Why the lag there?
I'm sorry?
Why was there such a time lag between the filing with the court and the actual filing of the document 6 months or so prior?
There's nothing that reflects that. We were not trial counsel. However, it looks like they were getting ready to file a motion for summary judgment. And because they were getting ready to file the motion for summary judgment, they were lining up their proof that they were the appropriate entity to have judgment entered in their favor. And just to address one more point, had the bearer paper been authenticated, there would have been no need to rely on the assignment of the mortgage. The only reason that the assignment of the mortgage comes into play at all was because there was not an authenticated copy of the bearer paper. And we end up going, there's two paths within 130331. You either have to be the holder or person in possession with the rights of a holder, and the assignment takes you down that second path.
Is there any challenge to standing at any point in the trial court?
Mr. Engel did challenge standing and raised the issue at that point in time. However, by the time the court entered judgment, the proof of standing was in the record.
This case kind of vividly demonstrates the opposing interests of the parties in this case, and not just the financial concerns, because the note and mortgage holder's interest is to speed up this process in order to get possession of the property, in order then to hopefully dispose of it and get its money back. The interest of the property holder, of course, is to slow down this process so that they have more time either to sell it themselves or to make other financial arrangements or other living arrangements. And so we find these two interests here in conflict in this case, don't we, pretty clearly?
Yes, Your Honor, you clearly do. Freddie Mac, like any plaintiff, would like to proceed to get its judgment so that it can obtain its relief. That's correct. We have skipped over one of the issues upon which there was a conflict among the Court of Appeals, and it has to do with the filing of the assignment of the mortgage. Both the First District and the Eighth District have held that in order to proceed with the foreclosure action, the filing of the assignment is required. That clearly is not the law. This court has long held that there is no obligation to record a mortgage in order to enforce the mortgage between the mortgagor and mortgagee. Similarly, there is no need to file an assignment of the mortgage as a condition of foreclosure. Under the doctrine of lis pendens, the filing of the complaint gives notice to the world that the plaintiff is claiming to be the mortgagee. The First and Eighth District's requirements, therefore, are incorrect, and the Second District's ruling on that point is something that the court should adopt. Your Honor, the need for bright-line rules on this is important. The courts below have adopted conflicting standards. We would ask the court to hold that to be entitled to enforce a mortgage, you must be a person entitled to enforce the note, that there is no requirement to be the recorded mortgagee in order to enforce, and finally, Your Honors, that Rule 17 means what it says, and that any defect in standing can be cured, and if it is not timely raised, any defect is waived.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Engel.
Thank you, Your Honor. There is one point that I want to clarify with respect to Freddie Mac's position that it was entitled to enforce the note. As Freddie Mac concedes in its briefing and as the Court of Appeals found, possession of the note under 130331 is an absolute requirement to either claiming holder status or claiming to be a non-holder with the rights of the holder. And here's the problem with the commencement of this lawsuit. As I stated before, no note was attached to the complaint. And in fact, Freddie Mac stated a copy of the complaint is unavailable. They didn't even have a copy of the note to attach to the complaint.
And you moved to challenge standing in the trial court, and that motion was denied?
No, sir. I did not file a motion to dismiss based on lack of standing prior to summary judgment. I raised the issue of a lack of standing in my answer. Then, after Freddie Mac filed a motion for summary judgment, I filed a cross motion for summary judgment, asserting a lack of standing when the case was filed and asserting a lack of jurisdiction for that reason.
And do I understand that at the time the court considered the motions or the cross motions for summary judgment, there had been the cure or there had been the subsequent assignment so that at the time the court considered it, there was no remaining issue. Is that
at the time the
accurate,
court,
or can you help
I believe it is. At the time the court entered judgment, there was evidence before the court that Freddie Mac was in possession of the note and had been transferred the rights of a holder by virtue of the assignment of mortgage. I've got an issue with whether or not Wells Fargo had the right to transfer had any rights to transfer in the note, and I've raised that in the brief. But the important point is that on the date the complaint was filed, there is no evidence in the record anywhere to indicate that Freddie Mac was in possession of the note. Now, as Justice Brown, indicated, it's ironic that one of the biggest actors in the U.S. residential mortgage market is coming in and asking the court to loosen the standards, the pleading standards, to deviate from what this court has repeatedly said, that standing is the preliminary issue and must be established before the courts can proceed to the merits.
If we rule in your favor, counsel, what's the next step as far as your client is concerned? Will there be a possibility of the new case being filed?
I would expect a new case to be filed, yes. But the difference is, if that were to occur, and assuming, in fact, Freddie Mac is in possession of the original note, at least then the judgment would have been granted by a court with jurisdiction.
Mr. Engel, what's the status of this property today? Are your clients still living in
it? No, they are not, Your Honor. This started because my Mr. Schwarzwald lost his job, and they've now moved to Indiana. The property was sold at sheriff's sale, and I believe title ostensibly sits with Freddie Mac.
And so a determination by this court then, which would be a ruling suggesting that you would need to have standing as it would relate to the facts of this case, would do what? since your clients no longer have the property and since it's already been transferred by sheriff's sale to another party?
Certainly. 2329.45 provides that if the underlying judgment in a case that involves the sale of a property, if that underlying judgment is reversed, the homeowner's claim would then turn into one for restitution. Now, how that's measured, you know, we haven't gotten there, certainly in the case that's going to be down the road a little bit, but the revised code provides for the status of the parties down the road. And that's another thing that's kind of important. You know, the sheriff's deed is proof of the transfer of the property, and it
well, what would you envision restitution might look like in this case?
It might relate to the loss of use of the property because of this rush to judgment that Freddie Mac undertook. Like I said, we haven't gotten there yet.
Sir, I assume there's a deficiency judgment in this case?
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe so. I cannot recall exactly how Freddie Mac bid at sale.
And then that loss of use, would that be the one-month period of the delay in transferring the assignment from April 15th till May 15th?
That would be one way of looking at it, Your Honor. Another way would be looking at it that they've been denied the loss of use for this entire period because there never was a judgment because the court never acquired jurisdiction in the first place.
Would you think it could go so far as to having the property transferred back to your client so they could start again?
Your Honor,
Or would that be outlandish?
I don't know that the revised code permits that. As I said, to me, it appears the General Assembly was actually thinking ahead and thought about whether or not it was going to disrupt land titles.
As we look at the landscape of all of those properties that may be affected by whatever decision we make here, we could have wholly new owners in some properties that have been foreclosed in similarly situated situations.
That's correct, Your Honor. But as I said, I think the revised code provides for that so as not to disturb the property rights of those individuals.
Thank you, Mr. Engel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, we will take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshall, would you call a recess, please?